And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We're going to talk to Eva Bartlett, and she is carrying the torch, I think you could say, of the woman, Corey. She was a young lady who went to Gaza and to the West Bank and worked there. And it, by the way, is a highly risky thing to do. Takes a lot of courage. Eva Bartlett is a journalist and an activist. She has been speaking in Canada and will be going to the United States. Rachel Corey.
Rachel, of course. That's her family name.
Yes, when I, you know, Phil has to be taught to look at his notes. That's what I think. But I think we're joined now by Eva Bartlett. Are you there, Eva?
I am, Phil. How are you?
Very good, and thank you very much for joining us. Can I just say, by the way, that I was mentioning Rachel Corey, and in some ways you've been described as someone who picked up the torch of the type of work she was doing. You were first went to Gaza. You were one of the people on those first flotillas, and then you stayed and worked with the fishermen and the farmers, and you were there when the Operation Cast Lead happened, a horrible moment. I wanted our listeners know that by way of background. Now, I noticed that this must have been an interesting event. You were in Fergus at the Melville United Church giving a report. That might be a nice place to start. What did you tell the people at the Melville United Church about your work and what they need to know?
Well, it was kind of funny, actually, because in the past couple of years, I've gone across Canada, and last November and December, I was actually in Western Canada and the Northwestern states, and I've been speaking about my experiences in Gaza in that what I've seen with the fishers and the farmers and the attacks and the aspects, the various manufactured crises mm-hmm. under the siege, the Israeli blockade on Gaza. So I've been speaking everywhere but my town, with the exception of my old high school. So I was very happy to get the chance to speak at the local church. Mm-hmm. And they actually included me in their Sunday service. So I had to whittle down the very many things I like to say about Gaza to a mere half hour. Mm-hmm. But that said, they were actually quite moved, and they said that they'd really like to have another event in the evening, allow me more time, and to invite our local MP and more people from the town. Uh-huh. So for me, this is a great achievement, even though it is a small town, because I think that people locally might connect with me more, and then therefore hopefully there'd be a ripple effect of people taking that torch, as you called it, and passing it on.
Yeah. I like everybody, you know, when we say Fergus, we're thinking, gee, that's heartland, and good for you. I mean, what sort of reception, what sort of questions did they have for them? I guess, did they know much about it? How did they regard what you were telling them?
You might know that the United Church in Canada actually has been more proactive in terms of Palestine. Many United Church members or ministers or members of the congregation have actually gone to occupied Palestine to witness. So they tend to be more informed. But that said, in my presentation, I usually show a number of photos from our work with the farmers when they're coming under fire from the Israeli army, our work with fishers when they're coming under heavy machine gun fire by the Israeli Navy, and then, as I mentioned, the various aspects of life under siege. And inevitably, many people in the audience end up crying because they're so appalled by what they're seeing. I mean, in many cases, they have a sense that something's not right in Palestine. They don't necessarily always know, depending on which the audience is. Mm-hmm. But when they see, for example, an elderly farmer just harvesting parsley and then coming under fire, or their entire families, they're very moved by that. And so usually their questions are, well, their comments are, I had no idea, and their questions are, how can this be happening? Mm-hmm. And what is our government doing about it? To which I answer, absolutely nothing. They're applauding Israel.
Yeah. By the way, of course, our timing is seems rather appropriate today. Our prime minister is visiting Israel. He's taken quite an entourage with him. He has given, apparently, they say, one of the few passionate speeches of his life at the Knesset. Now, Gaza, how does Gaza's gone through a particularly awful experience in the as part of the Palestinian struggle because of their isolation. Isn't that a big factor in the blockade on them? And what is this about? How long has this blockade been in place?
That's a good question, because most sources, most, you know, official or expert sources will say that it was enforced in mid-2007 after Hamas gained power over Gaza, even though Hamas had been democratically elected in early 2006 in elections supervised internationally and encouraged, you know, by bodies, U.S. and Canadian bodies. But when Hamas actually won that election, then, of course, the noose started to be tightened. Amir Ahas, actually, the great Israeli journalist for Haaretz, she always says, you know, the Israeli authorities were already closing the gates on Gaza back in the 90s after Oslo, probably earlier. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was a significant workforce from Gaza that used to work in construction and other kind of menial work in Israel. And so back even in the 90s and early 2000, the gates were being closed and permits were being denied to these workers. But then in 2006, after Hamas's election, and basically after Israel pulled out its illegal colonists in 2005, that gave the Israeli authorities kind of full rein to both lock down Gaza and then wage these intermittent, brutal and ruthless attacks on the population who are trapped within the walls of Gaza. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a huge, I mean, the blockade is so massive. It's not merely an economic blockade, as it's usually described in the media. It impacts on every single facet of life, including psychologically. When you have warships and you have tanks and you have war helicopters and war planes above you and the drones, which are also deadly lethal.
But I was surprised that I hadn't realized that the drones were in use there.
Oh, yeah, my goodness, yeah. During the attacks, I mean, prior to the attacks in 2008, they were in use, but certainly that was my first experience of any sort of drone. So there's at least two different types. I'm not a weapons expert, so I can only cite the basics that I know. Some are used for surveillance, and some are used for precision missile strikes. But the UN had a report after the attacks, and they cited the uses of drones. So did Palestinian Center for Human Rights. They have a very thorough and comprehensive report on breaking it down, how many people were killed by drones, which I believe was several hundred.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it again, the use of drones, in November 2012.
Yeah. We're speaking to Eva Bartlett. She's an activist and journalist. And by the way, a lot of my information came from ingaza.wordpress.com. Is that one of the better places? Do you have is that a good place to go for background on your work?
Well, I'd be biased if I said it was, because it's my blog.
I accept your opinion. Ngaza.wordpress.com.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights does, I would say, very good, usually fairly accurate reports.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in times of being attacked, it's hard to crank out a report very quickly. But I find that they're recognized as being accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So is Al Haq. I believe if you just Google Al Haq, it might be alhaq.com.
Yeah. By the way, you've been quite rigorous about being factual. You haven't, you yourself, people should recognize, have integrity as a journalist. If you say you saw something, you saw it. If you took a picture, you tell what's in the picture, et cetera. It's kind of important, right, that people realize that you have standards as well for people. It's not that you've gone there and are blind to issues, et cetera.
I think that's part of the reason some people find my talks compelling, because they are firsthand witnessing and evidence of, say, the criminal Israeli policies against farmers, the fact that farmers are denied one-third of their agricultural land, and this denial is enforced by brutal means such as machine gunning or shelling or bombing or abductions even.
And you've been standing there when it happened, right?
Yeah, our work...
has actually been... people have been firing toward you.
Sure, yeah. Similar to Rachel Corrie at the time in which she was in Gaza, the heavy policies and campaigns the Israeli army was waging was destroying homes. And so she was killed by an Israeli bulldozer when she was, among other ISM activists, trying to stop a bulldozer from destroying this home. now the policies are there. I mean, the Israeli military has a very visible presence within Gaza, but the major activities that IFM international activists partake in are accompanying farmers or previously fishers when they're trying to ply their trade, and being a visible presence, being in front of the farmers with the hopes that the farmers won't be killed on that particular day or maimed. We have had farmers who were injured while we were with them. And the huge irony is that not only are the Israeli army firing on these civilians, among whom are people that own the land, among whom are people that work as paid laborers, simply trying to contribute to their family's income, but the irony is also that this no-go zone that Israel imposes on the Gaza side, you know, they say 300 meters, it's documented to be up to 2 kilometers, mm-hmm. It's already a unilateral act, and then they fire on people who are outside of the so-called 300-meter border areas. So yes. when farmers we were with were attacked, more often than not, and when we came under heavy fire, we were on land that was 500 meters from the border or more.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad you raised that matter of the arbitrary setting, the 300 meters limit, et cetera, because when people speak of Gaza, often they turn it, particularly those who are apologizing for Israel's behavior there, they say, well, they pulled out, as though that's to be applauded. However, that was a unilateral act. There was no arrangement with any other sovereign party in order to guarantee a secure area. That was simply a withdrawal by soldiers, right?
Sure, and it was, and there were colonists in Gaza too. I believe it was around 5,000 or 6,000, and you know, by international standards, they shouldn't have been there in the first place. So, it wasn't a very generous act to pull out their colonists. And in fact, I believe that by doing so, then they can say, we've made a concession. Now Palestinians, who've already lost like 80-something percent of their
entirely
land.
Unilateral.
Sure. But then also with this came the unilateral policies of restricting farmers to less than, you know, than two-thirds of their farmland, and restricting fishers to roughly 15% of their fishing waters. Mm-hmm. All of this is unilateral.
Yeah.
And there's no body that will actually hold Israel accountable, even when it's known that Israel is firing on civilians.
Yes. Now, in reading an article about your work, the writer mentioned that the UNAWA abandoned Gaza. That's a United Nations operation. Is that how did? Could you describe that? I mean, that's a terrible setback for the people there, right?
Do you mean UNRWA?
Or maybe it's not accurate. I don't know.
I'm not familiar with UNAWA. There's the UNRWA.
RWA, yes.
I don't think it's fair to say they've abandoned. I mean, first of all, I don't believe that the UN really has done a whole lot for Palestine. They've issued tens of resolutions, which none of which are enforced. And they serve as a means to keep Palestinians alive, giving them handouts. I mean, obviously, when they're in such dire circumstances and manufactured poverty as they are now, they need these handouts. But the handouts themselves aren't sufficient. I mean, UN food aid basically comprises flour, oil, and maybe sugar, no produce, no proteins, et cetera. But it's not fair to say they've pulled out. Actually, with respect to Canada, I believe it's still the case that Canada cut its funding to the UN, so to these refugee programs that support the food aid and that support refugee education, you know, for the schools and garbage collection in the refugee camps. Mm-hmm. I know that certainly under the so-called siege, Canada was among the first countries to cut its ties with anything to do with Gaza, and I believe it also impacted on the UN. Mm-hmm. So I know that they have a severe funding problem, but that said, I don't really know how much good they do in Gaza anyway. I mean, certainly I think that most Palestinians would call for an opening of their borders and the ability to actually have exports and a functioning economy rather than being dependent on UN food aid.
Yes. Again, we're speaking to Eva Bartlett, and it's in gaza.wordpress.com to get basic information about the work of Eva and the issues for Gaza. Red Crescent is an internationally recognized organization which tries to provide services to people, like during the situation with Operation Cast Lead. You mentioned that their personnel are not protected, even though Geneva agreements on people like Red Crescent and Red Cross, they're supposed to be protected.
I first came into awareness of Red Crescent volunteers and employees being aggressed by the Israeli army back in 2007 when I was in Nablus. And so there was an Israeli military invasion into the old city, and we volunteers were walking with Red Crescent volunteers, taking people back to their homes because we were escorting them because they otherwise perhaps would be shot and killed or abducted. Mm-hmm. And in one case, we actually saw a Red Crescent worker who was with us be abducted, basically taken as a human shield. One minute he was escorting a woman to her home, the next minute he was blindfolded and handcuffed at the, you know, at the end of an Israeli soldier's gun.
And this is something you witnessed?
That was something I witnessed, yeah. And we were pleading for his release, and they basically said, you know, they didn't say anything to us. But it was obviously that they were holding him as a captive because they had invaded a house and they were occupying the house, so he was their collateral. So that was my first exposure, and then, of course, hearing stories from Red Crescent workers in Nablus who had been attacked.
That, by the way, without question, it'd be considered a war crime.
Certainly. I mean, it was an invasion. It wasn't, again, whenever we talk about war, it's always the Israeli army waging war on Palestine, and Palestine having no standing army or any of the any of the machinery of war. So it's always a war on Palestine. But yes, in Gaza, one of the reasons that we decided to accompany the Red Crescent medics was because already a few had been killed by the Israeli army while they were performing their duties. So we would ride in their ambulances, and in one case I was with a medic who, during so-called ceasefire hours, was sniped in his leg. Thankfully, he survived. He could have been killed. And another medic I worked with was killed. He was hit basically directly by a flechette or a dart bomb while he was retrieving injured and martyred, and his ambulance was fired upon, and he was basically shredded with these darts and went into shock and died. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the attacks, I believe it was 26 medics had been, or 16 medics, I'll have to check that. Mm-hmm. Many medics, it was either 16 or 26 mm-hmm. medics had been killed, and many, many more injured, ambulances damaged and destroyed, hospitals attacked. So countless war crimes. Yeah. And actually, I was just reading a report today about that, and the fact that 5 years on, you know, we've just passed the 5-year anniversary of these attacks. There's been no justice. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has submitted numerous appeals to the Israeli court, you know, citing their cases of their war crimes and their point-blank shootings of Palestinian civilians or the use of white phosphorus. And the report said, and this is actually citing a UN report, and it said, only one Israeli soldier has been prosecuted, and that was for theft of a credit card.
Did what?
Theft of a credit card. So, of course, there was looting that went on when the Israeli army occupied Palestinian homes, and desecration of the homes, smearing feces on the walls, turning things upside down, destroying the entire homes. Mm-hmm. But also, lots of Palestinians reported that their money, their jewelry, and other items had been stolen. Mm. So of all the atrocities, this is what apparently at least one soldier has been.
The one serious thing is a credit card.
Yeah.
Yeah, just quite a message comes from that. We're speaking to Eva Bartlett in Gaza.wordpress.com. And Eva, by the way, you are going to be touring the United States, and people can go to your website. They can learn about your talks, and they can learn about how they might be of help to get the word out about Gaza. I want to ask you, you were also one of the people who I worked with Mother Agnes Mariam, bringing her to North America. Why was that important to you, and what? How do you feel about her visit and what was done?
You know, to be honest, I didn't know much about Syria a couple of years ago, but when I started reading more and more news reports about what was going on in Syria, you know, the Saudi and Gulf state backing of terrorists in Syria, how whatever revolution there might have been in the early days had been co-opted by the West, by NATO, by Israel, by Turkey, by Jordan. You know, I think anybody that reads those reports with an open mind would agree that, first of all, the West should get out of Syria, stop interfering, that it's obviously an attempt at regime change in Syria, and that the Syrian people should be the ones to determine their own future. So Mother Agnes is a nun. She's actually Palestinian-Lebanese, but she's lived in Syria for 2 decades. And she and other nuns that work with her have been doing some very serious humanitarian work, in fact, meeting with both sides. And that's her whole stance, is that she supports what they say in Arabic, musalaha, which means reconciliation, and that it should include all Syrian people, that it should be a Syrian decision. And so she's been very influential in getting Syrian civilians who are trapped in areas held by rebels, or where there's fighting between the Syrian army and the rebels holding an area, and actually evacuating thousands of Syrian civilians. And aside from that, she's witnessed quite a bit, and her word actually contradicts a lot of the corporate media reporting on so-called crimes of the Syrian government.
Yeah.
So I felt, and I think the people that we worked with felt, that she had a strong message, and that people in North America had deserved at least the option to hear what she had to say, and hear a different narrative to what the corporate media is saying.
Yeah. By the way, people should appreciate, she's not in an easy situation. The Catholic Church has suffered loss of people, and they have a duty. And by the way, the Vatican itself has spoken out about the attacks, sectarian attacks from terrorist elements. But, you know, there's nobody as deaf as the one who will not hear. It's really wonderful you and others brought her here.
Well, you know, there was great support for her, too. I mean, May Read McGuire supported her and called her a voice of truth. Even when she was in the States, a U.S. senator had great words of admiration for her, saying that she's played a major role in negotiating for the benefit of peace and stability. She was awarded a certificate of special congressional recognition for her humanitarian work.
Mm-hmm.
So people that have heard her message or are willing to hear her, and also Eve Engler, the Canadian journalist, applauded her words, and like the fact that she was offering a different narrative of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting that Mother Agnes, back in September 2013, was among the few journalists that was actually willing to look critically at what happened in Ghouta and ask the question, was it really the Syrian government? She didn't deny that attacks had occurred, but she asked, how did it really occur?
Mm-hmm.
And now we see in recent months and weeks that more and more reports in mainstream, MIT, you know, people saying that actually the whole trajectory of the missiles doesn't mm-hmm. mesh with the U.S., you know, John Kerry's.
Yes, I noticed the New York Times is kind of crawling down from its original attempt to provoke trouble.
Mm-hmm. But at the time, Mother Agnes Miriam was defamed for having even dared to contradict this, and now it's coming mm-hmm. out more and more mainstream sources, and even NGOs are actually saying, well, you know what, there's some truth to it. They're not acknowledging her, of course, but they're just saying there's some. You know, yeah. Possibility that perhaps it wasn't the Syrian government.
Yeah. Well, based on what you're telling me, I agree with those. And I think the woman from Ireland, Myriad, is it?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're nominating Mother Agnes for the Nobel Prize, and I would join them. I think what you just told us is the basis.
I would, except the fact that Obama got it kind of takes away any sort of meaning that it has. But certainly.
You're right. He's kind of cheapened it a bit. Eva, you've done great work. We look forward to following your visits and travels to American cities. We want to hear more about it, so I hope we can talk to you soon about what you learn in your lecturing.
Thank you. If anybody does want to contact me, my email address is on my blog in gaza.wordpress.com, and I would really welcome any sort of suggestions, and if you have any contacts in the States, so I can reach out to a broader audience. That would be wonderful, because all I'm trying to do is share what I've seen. And really, Gaza is suffering so critically under power outages, under flooding, under sewage overflows. They really need our solidarity and support. So that's my main purpose. And if you can help me in any way, I'd appreciate it.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you very, very much. And we look forward to talking to you again.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Eva Bartlett. And again, that's ingaza.wordpress.com. You've been listening to The Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I want to thank Andy and Phil Conlon, and we will see you next week.